Under the skin.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom. You're listening to Under the Scales. Thanks for coming back for the second part of my interview with Benji Eisen. In the first part, if you recall, Benji discussed writing a book with Bill Kreutzmann and working for Bill as the Fare Thee Well shows were being rehearsed and performed. Right as that episode ended, Benji was asking me what it was like for me to see Trey in that role.
It's interesting because for you to watch that and for you to see, Trey be in the dead, you first had the whole Trey's and Fish thing, did you think, with Fish, like, this is no longer, my friend's band is no longer just like the second best high school, open mic band.
It took me a while, actually. Like, it was after the album Junta and, when I started realizing again, because Trey and I we had times where we were very, very close in our youth together, and then we sort of drifted apart, and then fate sort of would bring us back together and then apart again. And I remember there was a time period where I wasn't there when a lot of what came out as Junta, the double album, came out. And to me, it was like, wow, they could have used some lyrics. I mean, Fee was on there and Esther, which have amazing lyrics which prove that Trey, when he put his mind to it, could come up with lyrics. But Dinner in a Movie, and I Love Steve, but those lyrics aren't super duper complex. And I was kind of thinking, hey, here's a spot for me. Maybe I could write some more lyrics with Trey. And that's kind of when I started sending a whole bunch of stuff to him after hearing that.
It's funny. I wanted to... And earlier today, it crossed my mind that I wanted to almost try to call you out about this lyrical, timeline and arch about how, like, Fish went from – I got to talk to Mike Gordon about this, actually, from his perspective, about how, in Fish, you have Dinner in a Movie and you have, Divided Sky. You have all these songs in which the lyrics are very – they're not always silly, sparse. But they're sparse, and also they don't really – they're not like, oh my God, I have such a crush on the girl in front of me, but she doesn't know I exist. They're very open for meaning, the music, the meaning is in the music, embedded in the notes.
Even when they're more verbose, I like to think that the meaning is still in the music in a way,
Well, that's what I was getting at, is I was going to say, one criticism I've heard, and it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because, Fish's lyrics, I think, and I'll tell you this honestly right now, I think that some of my favorite lyrics, which you've written, by the way, I think are extremely deep and meaningful and poignant and flexible as well, and that I can relate to them in different parts of my life, different times I've applied them to different things. But I think a lot of people don't see that because they're used to these overt lyrics of, oh, I like you so much, baby. I like you so much, baby.
Well, I appreciate that. I totally appreciate that. I mean, that's one of the, I've said this in many different ways and in many different forums, whether it's on my podcast in different episodes or when other people have asked me about lyrics, because that's what they'll do to the lyricist. People come up to me and say, hey, Tom, I really, really love Theme from the Bottom because it's about me and my girlfriend. It exactly explains what's going on in our relationship. And then he'll go, right? Isn't that what you wrote it about? And I have to say, right. I will always, because he's right.
Wouldn't it be better if he said free and then you're like, so you're going to push your girlfriend off the edge of a ship,
that's another interpretation that we don't like to go into as much.
We don't know. I mean, is bouncing around the room about masturbation? Who knows? Who's to say?
You can have it be, Benji, whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, totally.
Just don't tell
totally.
Me.
Yeah. There was this argument that I used to make. I remember my friend Susie Duncan, who was a really good friend of mine in college, she had this revelation once when she was trying to justify Fish's lyrics to a friend of ours. And she said that, she grew up on Bob Dylan because that's what her parents listened to. And she said that she saw more meaning in a song that the lyric was just possum, your end is the road, because it was just a purely, you know, it became an instrument. It was right. Just this word for the sake of a word.
Songs, of course, completely, perfectly, wonderfully valid if they paint an amazing picture and every single puzzle piece is complete. That's a wonderful way of writing. I think it's always been probably why Trey was drawn to my style, is that often the puzzle pieces, they're either missing or I kind of write around whatever the point is without really saying it overtly. And leaving it open for interpretation. And I think he writes music that way. And together it sort of allows the listener to weave a different story almost while you're listening.
Yeah. You know, I was, like you said, I agree. I was going to call you out, like you said earlier, about how, you know, there's this been a move towards writing more straightforward songs, but then I thought about it and you're not guilty of that at all. Cause I was like, you know, I was about to almost like, I wanted to be able to make fun of you and be like, oh yeah, how do you go from setting sail? I hit a whale and my ship sank right away. You know, Fast Enough for You is a better example. How do you go from, you know, if time were only part of the equation, and all of those,
and you
know, following
the boundaries of our case. Yeah.
If time were only part of the equation, could draw the boundaries of our cage, you wouldn't pile another stone upon me, and I'd be happy just to watch you age.
Yeah, exactly. How do you go from something so beautiful like that to and then as I tried to get an example, I was like, oh, from Big Boat, I was like, you know, the ones I'm thinking of actually aren't your lyrics, because then you wrote No Man in No Man's Land, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and those lyrics, once you sit down and read them, are incredible. I think I know what you're saying, and I definitely agree with what I think I know you're saying.
which is as good as I can hope for, you know.
Yeah, and it's a perfect song that when everything everything that's going on in the world right now is happening, for me to want to just dance down on a beach in Mexico too, you know.
Well, like, that's great. Well, I really like that, and it was great down in Mexico where you were not, I understand.
I wasn't. I was there last year. This year, I had to. I'm managing a band called Reed Mathis and Electric Beethoven, and was preparing for our own tour and jam cruise.
All right. Well, just I know that you, because you're you. You were glued to the live stream on Live Fish. And
yeah.
What was your night of the three?
Well, night three was a gold medal winner. No, you know, no doubt. It was
no question.
Night three was just phenomenal. You know, you were there. Do you agree?
Oh well, yeah. I mean, Boogie On Outdoors for me is kind of like. I mean, I love Punch You in the Eye for outdoor shows. Boogie On and Yamar are kind of, they trigger something in me about festivals, and I got both Boogie On and Yamar in the same set. And it started with Simple, which is one of my all-time favorite songs, right into Tweezer Rogue, and then Nothing came out of the blue.
Nothing's ensconced, nothing's entrenched, nothing's entangled or twisted or wrenched. Everything smoothly flows right through my head. What I had hoped might linger is swept off instead.
That was intense. I love that song. And then Ghost. And then Yamar. I mean, it was just an amazing first set just for me personally. And it didn't end there. It ended with, what was it, Fluffhead, I think.
Yeah, yeah, with Love Fest. You know, it's interesting to hear you say that.
We forgot Rift.
Rift, yeah. To hear you say that, you know, and Rift, by the way, what, talking about the way that lyrics have changed, Phish lyrics have changed over time. Rift, to me, the album was such a, you know, again, it was like when I first got into Phish, and I was like, oh yeah, their songs are just sort of like, you know, hey, you know, like tires are the things that make contact with the road,
right?
You know, but then when I realized that all these songs that I've been singing for at that point, like a year or more, actually have really deep meanings, I think Rift is such a great, the whole album, I mean, is such a great
example of. That was kind of the beginning of, in a way, a beginning of some sort of a switch kind of turned on in a way for me right around the Rift time. I was able to kind of tap into something then, a different type of songwriting style.
Yeah, totally. And again, it goes right through the latest album, where I really think that, you know, people that think that Phish's lyrics, because it's such a common criticism, is that the songs don't mean, you know, X or Y or Z, and that's only because people aren't listening to the lyrics. You know, they're not looking at the words.
Thanks, man. Well, my songs on Big Boat are Blaze On, No Men in No Man's Land, and then Running Out of Time, which was actually written a long time ago, believe it or not. And my band Amphibian even came out with a version of it. I'm not sure if people know. I'll put that on my SoundCloud so people can hear.
Yeah, I didn't know that Amphibian did that.
Yeah, I think Amphibian's version is called Thunderclap.
Oh, okay.
And definitely kind of different style lyrics from Trey's songs and Paige's songs and Mike's songs on there for sure.
Well, Trey once said, and I'll never forget this, I've used this as an example actually countless times with, I used it with the members of the Grateful Dead. I remember talking about it with them, saying, you know, how, I think Trey said that, you know, music says such a music speaks on such a deep level to us that a song like Divided Sky, for instance, where the lyrics aren't very instructive, you know, like you wrote them on the rhombus and had this incredible experience and kind of embedded that in the music.
Yes.
But it's the journey of the music is what makes that song so powerful.
Right.
And if the lyrics during Divided Sky had been like, can you stop at the ATM so I can get money out of the, you know, out of the machine, it cheapens the song, because then that's all the song is about, when the song can be about so much more.
Ah, well, you know, I love
and,
that.
Right.
Sometimes taking away, you know, adds more. Yep. No question.
But then I read recently that Trey said something about how he thinks direct lyrics that, you know, you can, that are very specific, are the ones that people, you know, can relate to. And I don't know if I agree with that, because I come from more of the Tom Marshall school of lyricism.
I very much appreciate that. I mean, of course, I love Bob Dylan songs, and there's tons of songs, Paul Simon songs, that do kind of tell a little tiny chapter, and every single piece is included. But yeah, like you said, and I think Trey might be a little bit maybe going in that direction. I'm not positive if I am, nor if there's even a real line between it, but thanks for pointing it out.
Yeah, well, keep doing you, man. Keep doing you. You know, I would be remiss if that's actually a word I don't think you've ever used out loud. I would be remiss if I didn't mention this funny experience that I had that you were a part of, actually. I had a dream a couple years ago at this point, when in my dream I heard Phish playing this song that I had never heard them play before. It's not a real song, but in my dream it was a fully realized Phish song. And when I woke up, I was at that point. You actually wrote in a different song about that moment when you're kind of half awake, half asleep.
Oh yeah.
I can't describe
the feeling when.
I can't describe the feeling when. Bed asleep, and then I wake up with a vision blurred, and all my efforts are deterred.
Yeah, exactly.
That, yeah.
And I was having one of those moments. I woke up and I could feel the dream escaping from me, and nobody could make a soundboard recording of my dream.
Right.
So I knew the song was, like, I grabbed my phone and I opened it up, and Twitter was there. And I tweeted the line that I remembered about, and I didn't say these are lyrics. I didn't give any context. It was the middle of the night. I just tweeted the only lyrics that I remembered from my dream before the rest of them faded.
Right.
And I went back to bed and I woke up and you had favorited that tweet.
That's awesome. Do you remember offhand what it was?
I know it had the song. I know it had the word Rubicon in it.
It's
like crossing the Rubicon or something like that.
It's because I love that word, probably, and also I follow I follow every tweet you do, but I love that word because back in the old Princeton Day School days with my band and back. Mark Daubert and I wrote a song called Halcyon Rubicon.
Maybe that was the song in my dream.
That was the song in your dream. And then really, really quickly, what you were describing was pretty much exactly that happens to me all the time. Rarely is it a band that's playing. It's more just somehow there's words in my head when I wake up. Those you have to immediately write down. But I want to say this one particular song, I was able to remember four entire verses from my dream. And it was Crowd Control, and it was Fish who was playing it. And I even remember the crowd turning around and the devil facing the band. And the band turned around. It was like really, really, really vivid. And I had the whole song. And that entire song came from a dream.
Listen now, I'm talking. I've been here for weeks. Waiting in this growing crowd, staring at my feet. The world around me is turning, I'm just standing still. The time's come for changes, do something or I will.
That's incredible. Not to step on your rhythm and steal all your lines, but that's that is the story of the ghost, right? Like that's idea of like your muse. Because I have that too. You know, in writing Deal, I would have very specific. There's entire passages in Deal that I wrote as soon as I woke up, or else like I would hop out of the shower and quickly dry my hands because I would hear these words come. And that's how I write. And I think that's how you do too.
Yes. Many, many artists have said when you do hear the whisper of the muse that you immediately got to listen. You have to.
Yeah.
And it'll come to you. It'll come to you in crazy places. And that's why now we're so lucky. We have these voice recorders in our phone. Mine is just filled with stuff. It's just most of it embarrassing and awful. And yet every now and then there's a gem.
Yeah, when the words float on the breeze, I see you just write so many that are so just subconsciously like there. But I have my notes on my iPhone where I will sometimes to my chagrin because I won't give it context. I'll like have a phrase that pops in my head, and I have hundreds and hundreds of notes now on my iPhone, of them way out of context, and I'm like, yeah, maybe I'll use that for a sentence somewhere.
There you go. Know? That's the way to do it. Well, Benji, it's important. Just for context, to tell people who you are in the Fish world. And the way that I met you indirectly at first, of course, we met eventually, was you did everyone in the pre-Facebook, pre-MySpace era on the internet a huge favor by creating something called Benji's Digest, which was, if I remember, a weekly sort of summary of the cool stories that appeared on rec.music.fish. Is that correct? Am I getting this right?
Yeah, it kind of reveals how little of a life I had for a while because, I was so obsessed with Fish when I first got into them that I wanted to learn everything I could about this band. And part of that was reading the news groups. And at that point, there was Fantasy Tour right now is a good example. Paul Glace is a friend of mine. And I don't know how you can't read everything on Fantasy Tour. There's just no time and no, you'd go insane. But luckily the way that message boards are these days, you can read the heading of the topic.
Right.
And at the time this was the dawn of the internet. And so I would be in a college computer lab and there'd be, all these, the Rec Music Fish would have a lot of posts all at once. and a lot of it was bullshit. And so Rosemary was doing it. I don't remember her last name now.
Oh, yeah, Rosemary's Digest. That's right.
Yeah, Rosemary was doing it first, and I used it, and I really appreciated it. And she needed to kind of like the Dread Pirate Roberts hand it off to somebody else. and I was, you know, a college kid at the time. And I was like, I'll do it. And I remember actually she got mad at me. I think she regretted her decision. She got mad at me. And so did some other people because I didn't do it every day because I was seeing fish for about a week. And I was like, I'm out here doing the things that we're talking about. You know, like, I'm sorry, not sorry. You know, so.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, just for a tiny, tiny bit of summary. So I guess there was a thing called the Usenet where it was just an early rudimentary way of people with similar interests would form a news group, I guess is what it was called. And so the powers that be allowed there to be one called rec.music.fish. And that's where all the fish heads that had a computer in 19, would this be 96, 7?
No, this was 95, 94. Oh, yeah, 94, 95.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Maybe by the time I did the digest, it was probably 96, 97. Yeah, but were you on Rec Music Fish? Did you read that?
I read it. I did. I didn't contribute much. And then by the time I was contributing, this thing called AOL had happened. And then they had something called the Fishbowl. And on there, I was Jesmond, Jesmond, on the Fishbowl.
Yeah, I remember that. I just thought that, you know, Fish's internet presence early on, they were one of the first bands to really pioneer the internet as, you know, because the Grateful Dead had the tape trading network, and that was all by mail, by post.
Right.
You know, and Fish really was the first band to come along to create a community online.
I don't know if people know that about Fish. Yeah, we were kind of the first internet savvy band in a way, which was really cool.
I got on the internet. I signed up for my very first email account specifically so that I could learn more about Fish because I had just gotten into them. I was a brand new noob. I was a noob, and I didn't know anything about them. And I was like, how do I find out? And I heard there was a news group, and I signed up for the internet for that purpose.
Okay. And then, of course, I mean, if we, you know, just to keep it short, summarize your entire life from that moment to now, like, how'd you wind up with Bill Kreutzmann? You basically made a career out of music, right?
Yeah, I mean, I jokingly was about to say sum it up shortly, acid, but that's a joke. Yeah, I mean, it's follow your bliss, and, you know, doors will open where you previously only saw walls, as Joseph Campbell said.
Right. Okay.
You know, so I kind of was just, you know, I was always good at writing, and
you became a writer in the music world.
I became a writer in the music world, and I'm an ideas man, Michael. So I just had lots of ideas, and happened to have Bill Kreutzmann's ear. And I was managing a little bit before then too.
Okay.
And dabbling with promotion, and I put on a festival with the Disco Biscuits,
right,
stuff like that. But it was always just sort of me flipping and flamming around, marching to the tune of whatever tune caught my attention.
Well, and you're being very humble, of course, because you named some of the most powerful people in music offhandedly a little while ago. We don't need to go into that, but it's clear that you've been in the right place more than once.
Oh, you know what I am, Tom? I feel this. I am Forrest Gump of the Fish world. You know, that, like, you know, there's been things in which I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if? And then all of a sudden you're looking up and it's like, oh, yeah, the Grateful Dead and Trey are playing in a stadium. And wouldn't it be cool if? And all of a sudden, you know, like these, you know, with Billy and the Kids, I remember I had them play Chop Dust in an arena in North Carolina for the Christmas Jam for Warren Haynes. And I did that because I saw Fish there. And I'm like, wouldn't it be cool if coming back here, all of a sudden I get to see Bill Kreutzmann play a Fish tune? You know? And so it's like Forrest Gump, okay. You know?
All right, well, that's cool. And then that might sort of, in a weird way, in a Forrest Gump way, serve to explain or excuse your behavior in the past to me. See if you remember it the same way that I do. I think I got I think you were trying to give me credit for something, but I took it as someone was giving me blame for it. What the heck was up with the Uno cards?
So the
Uno,
man, you
Uno get being that weird game that I only knew through grade school French class, where teacher brought out an Uno card game and it had like all kinds of French words and cars and stop signs and shit. And I had no idea what an Uno was. And then suddenly I'm being blamed for starting the Uno card craze in 1994 for Fish.
Yeah, but at that point I was already on to Dos and Tres. But I can't take credit for the Uno either. The person you're going to want to talk to is a guy named a character who's probably in the 400 plus club, named Ryan Clay or Uno Clay.
All right.
And he started, you know, my sense of humor, I think that I have a similar sense of humor that you do, and certainly that the band has had on display in the past. And it's sort of like an absurdist, you know, slant to it at sometimes. And this sort of arbitrary. In college, there's a thing we did called Mund, which is when you do something with a lot of importance. Like, let's say you jump out, you run out of the dorm room and you run out into the quad and you grab a branch from a tree and you run back in the room and you throw it in the middle of the floor and you go, Mund, it means nothing, you know, but and that's what, you know, most people live their lives like a Mund. And so, when Clay handed me an Uno card in a show at Worcester for one of the Thanksgiving Fish shows, I immediately went with it and put it in my hat, and you know, other friends of his were doing the same thing.
It was a Mund moment.
Yeah, it was a Mund moment, and it kind of spread and caught on. And for me, it was a lot of fun to hand out these cards and see people's reactions, because it's like, what's it mean? Is this a cult? Well, is it a cult? You know, is this a game? Is it a game?
You
know?
Right, I see.
So, and people had all these different theories, and a lot of them pretended to know. They're like, oh yeah, I'm an Uno kid, and this is what it means, and this is what it means, and this, and it's like, okay, you know, it doesn't really, to me, I mean, maybe Clay might have a different perspective on it, but to me there's just this humorous element of it really didn't mean anything at all. It was kind of a Mund.
Well, so, and just to fill everyone in, so there was a time period, and I want to say 94 or 95, where you couldn't go to an outdoor or you know, a shed show without seeing Uno cards either in people's hands or on the floor after they've been discarded. And then I started reading or being asked by people why I brought Uno cards, and it was me. And I guess somehow you or someone credited me for coming up with the concept. And I, as recently as 5 years ago, someone asked me that, Tom, why did you start that Uno card craze?
Well, I'm a fan of propaganda, which is what the Uno thing was. But I don't know about the misinformation. I don't know where that okay. came. Wait, hold on a second. Did the Uno cards come from you?
Okay, I understand. It's one of those. Got it. Anyway, I think mystery solved on the Uno cards.
I handed one to Gordon too, and this was, I mean, this was before I've worked with him, you know, in other things, but this was way before then. And I think at the Theater of Living Arts, I handed him a card, and I am pretty sure he knew what to do with it. I just don't know what that was.
he took it with great Mund.
He took it with great Mund.
Perfect. Well, then you gave it to the right person, because I clearly was the wrong one. So the last thing, and I remember somewhere you claiming credit for being the guy that came up with the idea that the audience would say Hood during Harry Hood, when the band said Harry, and then everyone says Hood, Harry, is that really attributable to you? Because I also know there's another dude that takes credit for it, Darius something.
Darius Zelker, yeah. Darius was you could definitely credit him with the the fact that everybody does it. So basically, blame him. But my role in it was this. It was the spring of 2000. It was the spring of 1996. I was living in Northampton, Massachusetts. I was pretending to go to college. I was definitely acing my class in Hippie 101 or Head 101 or something like that. But
been there. Yeah,
ignoring my other classes entirely, and you know, I was probably caught up doing things like kind of like drum circles in front of City Hall, the kind that you probably would talk about in Birds of a Feather, you know, things like that. And I was so, at that point in my life, I was so just in, I was, as Kerouac would say, I was mad to live, mad to breathe. You know, I was just full of life and brimming over with enthusiasm.
Awesome.
And I picked up on, you know, I was listening to 90% of what I was listening to was Phish, which I don't recommend. I recommend a wide swath, but at that point, 90% of everything I was listening to, if not more, was Phish. And I was driving around Northampton, and I had been on this kick where James Brown somehow came into my charge. I don't remember listening to a lot of James Brown, but I remember picking up on his "huh," and you know, I would love to do it inappropriately, like, you know, do you want fries with that? Huh? You know,
that wouldn't be at all annoying. Yeah.
No, totally. I was, you know, so I was inserting the "huh" wherever I could, and definitely inappropriately. You know, is my favorite place to do it. But in my car by myself, I was listening to, you know, when Phish would come on, when they would do a downbeat, I would go, "huh," you know, even in Wilson, you know, like where a game hinge, I'd go, "huh." And for Hood, when that happened, I remember the intersection I was at, because I was high on life, I mean, and I was, right. You know, I started, this was before, this was before anyone knew how to LOL. We were actually laughing out loud. And so I laughed out loud because I thought it was really funny, because here I am just, you know, a kid driving around in my car going, "huh," and it fit. Like, it was like, "hood." And I was like, "oh my God, that's funny." Like, that's, it was a funny thing to stumble upon, but not something that 20 years later we should, you know, still, it was an inside joke with myself.
So you were "hooing" and it became "hood."
Yeah, it became and I thought that was really funny, because it was like Harry "huh," and it was also the inflection when he did, and the fact that I was by myself talking out loud in my car, you know, doing "huh."
Right.
Everything about it was funny to me, and I told my best friend Matt McGuire about it, and he laughed, and we started doing it, I think, you know, once or twice, but that was it. And then Darius Zelker asked for ideas for Red Rocks, he wanted to prank the band. Love pranks, as the band does, of course.
Definitely.
And so I was like, you know, I submitted that idea. I may have thought of another idea and submitted it, but it obviously didn't take. But cut to being at Red Rocks, and I Darius printed out thousands of these flyers and handed them out. And they had a number of ideas on them. One of the other ideas, I think, was like during the silent part of the Divided Sky, everybody was supposed to turn around. and, you know, it was like some funny stuff. And they played "Hood," and the entire place yelled "Hood," you know. And
oh my God.
It just worked. And I remember, you know, I laughed my ass off, because I was like, this is my own inside joke, and here I am, you know.
That's
like
fantastic.
8,000 people living out my inside joke, which I imagine for you, actually, and I imagine for Trey, that happens a lot, because there's a lot of inside jokes with lyrics and stuff.
And
you know, to look around and to see it, to see it on t-shirts and stuff must be a trip, because you know, great. these are inside jokes. And so to me, I got to kind of play that part of having my inside joke being.
I'll have to ask Trey like what that was like being at Red Rocks the first time the whole audience knew to yell "hood."
Yeah, totally.
That's pretty intense. That's a good prank. That's kind of a lot cooler than being the guy that started the wooing.
Well, yeah. Well, you know, the woo got me off the hook.
That's hilarious.
There is one thing I do want to add very quickly, Tom,
please,
and that's the full circle with Trey with the "hood" chant. And that's that, you know, going back to the beginning of this conversation, it was the last day of the Fare Thee Well, you know, shows. It was set break. And I knew that the next time I saw Trey would probably be the dynamic was going to be different, because here I was in the once in a lifetime, you know, thing where I was managing a project that he was, you know, I was one of these managers of a project that he was a part of. Right. And our talks, you know, he listened to me in terms of, like, we talked about the set list and things that, you know, things like that on a professional level. And I went up to him. I knew I was never going to have that dynamic again. And so I went up to him and I said, Trey, I want you to know I'm really proud of you. You know, as that you played these shows like yourself, never once trying to be anybody but yourself. But at the same time, every note you played belonged in these songs. And that was like the key to making it work. And you did it. And he started beaming and he said, you know, that the Grateful Dead, they come from a generation that they don't communicate to each other. So, you know, I don't think Bob Weir ever told Trey, hey, good job. You know, that would never occur to him. You know, like
seemed to the audience, though, that they did, at least by the hugs and the body language and the smiles.
Yeah, totally. And that was kind of at the end of that second set that day, you know, like, but, and I guess the previous days, I mean, Trey knew that everybody loved him, but,
yes, yeah.
But nobody, you know, nobody would come right out and just be like, yeah, I'm proud of you. And this is why it worked and blah, blah. So, you know, he started beaming and then he got serious for a second and he said, tell your boy. And by that, he meant Billy. He said, tell your boy that I owe him my life. And my face kind of, I think he saw this, my face changed because I wasn't sure what he meant, because I know, like, changed my life. Like, I could say Fish changed my life, you know, right. So I got that, but owing my life, I would never say that about Fish.
Right.
And so I got, you know, this confused look, and Trey repeated it. He said, tell your boy I owe my life, in the same way that every reggae artist owes their life to Bob Marley and every bluegrass artist owes their life to Bill Monroe.
Oh, wow.
And then Trey got teary-eyed and he goes, I live a wonderful life and I get to do what I want to do. And what I want to do is play guitar and play music. And I get to do that for people that will support me and see me no matter what it is and no matter where I go. And I owe all of that to the Grateful Dead. And he was being, you know, incredibly sincere and poignant and, you know, literally misty-eyed. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, like, do I pat him on the back and go, good talk, you know, or do I say, well, you know, in some ways that's how you are to me. You know, I didn't know what to do. And so I said, well, is now the time I tell you? And I started grinning and he gave me that same look I had given him, that confused look of, you know, like, and I go now. And the stage manager was making the call. Like, they had to get on stage in about 2 minutes. Right. You know, Robbie Taylor was rounding people up, and I was like, it's not. And Trey's like, yeah, tell me. And I go, I did the hood chant. And I wrote an essay about it for like jambands.com years ago, and I printed it out. I had it in my pocket thinking, I probably will never give this to him, but I'll just have. And at that moment, I was like, yep. And I handed it to him. I go, yep, that was me. I did it. And, you know, the first time I ever admitted, outed myself as a true fan, and let alone somebody that may have ruined one of his songs. And I, before he could react, I walked away and I'm walking across the stage and I turned around and he was laughing. So
that's great. Well, actually, it's probably, in a way, it's an unusual answer and an unusual response, but it's probably like the best response, because nothing you said, like you said, could, like, good chat would have worked right then. And sometimes changing the topic in a funny way is perfect. That is a beautiful sentiment that you kind of were able to convey to him, and vice versa. And
walking away from him for the sake of a joke, you know. Yeah. I don't think people walk away from him a lot.
No, I agree.
Like, yeah, totally.
That's really great. Well, a lot of mysteries were solved, at least for me, the Uno thing and the Hood thing, and really, really great talking to you about this great book. The book, of course, is called Deal by Bill Kreutzmann and Benji Eisen, whom we're speaking to right now. And it's been wonderful, Benji, catching up with you. And like I said before, you're coming out with what's the band that you're going to be touring with?
Well, I'm touring with Reed Mathis and Electric Beethoven right now, which is an unbelievable heavily type 2 band, a lot of improvisation. It's actually interesting because there's kind of an overlap with the fish community in so much as some of the fish guys have been involved. We have not been playing that up because, you know, like, we don't want to exploit that since that's not the focus of the project, but it is really cool. And it's something that I personally, as a fish fan, love.
Well, also,
and
I'll tell you, I mean, if you show up at a show and expect Mike, just because Mike has played, it kind of sucks if he's not there, if that's why you go.
Yeah, totally. And we don't want that. We don't want that at all. But to me, it's exciting the fact that it has the exciting part about that participation is it seems to have Fish's stamp of approval, which I really like. But the project is not focused on anything like that. It's not focused in the jam band world. It's Reed Mathis has taken Beethoven's Third Symphony and a Sixth Symphony specifically and for good reasons. He went around the country to all of his favorite musicians and collaborators, and this is where Fish is involved because he recorded at the Barn with Paige, and he also recorded with Mike. But Beethoven himself, what got lost in history is Beethoven was an improviser. He didn't want to be this composer guy. He wanted to improvise, and when he was losing his hearing, that's what he was mourning, was that he couldn't improvise anymore. He would show up at people's houses and they would play, you know, like the latest mode, you know, they'd play the latest whatever, and he would one up them by then going to the piano and playing it, but adding to it and, you know, doing the jamming, you know.
Classical improvisation, which is a weird thing.
Well, we call what this band does CDM for classical dance music. So Reed took these forms from Beethoven and went around the country and had an amazing cast of people just, you know, contribute to it. In addition to Paige and Mike, there's also Joe Russo, Marco Benevento, Stan and Moore, you know, just the list goes on. It's amazing. And then for the live thing, he took the people that he felt could go out on stage and fully improvise. Fish fans will know it as type two. You know, like, totally go type two Beethoven.
Really?
so it's taking these Beethoven forms, but it doesn't, it only sounded exactly like the symphonies the very first time they did it. And since that, they jump off cliffs, not only every song or every movement, but like every bar of music, you know, they would jump off it and loop it and make it, you know, you dance to it while they're kind of improvising and finding new spaces. And sometimes it goes into reggae, sometimes it goes into, like, you know, dark spaces, sometimes it gets super groovy. It's all these different things. But this is a four piece rock band, you know, lineup.
Okay.
And that there's, you know, it's keyboards, drums, bass, guitar.
Okay.
And
so they're already interpreting in a way. They're already, like, I'm not going to say dumbing down, but they've already reduced the classical piece. And they,
distilled,
and
yeah.
They, yeah, yeah, distilled it. Okay, very good. So they purified it.
And, it's a lot. It's 150 proof.
Okay, good. Wow, it's very strong now. Beethoven would approve. And the familiarity of the musicians with the music allows them to sort of step into space, so to speak.
They're comfortable, like how comfortable they are with each other and how safe they feel on stage, because they know that they can each, you know, it's Reed's band, but any one of them, it's all of their bands, because any one of them at any moment could jump off a cliff and they know that they're going to be caught because they know that the other three guys are going to be right with them. Of course,
right.
You know, to you and me, this is not a new concept because we've seen it with Fish. And
you and I jump off cliffs all the time.
Yeah, all the time. and we've seen it with other bands as well, obviously.
Yes.
You know, but it seems like, you know, with Beethoven, when he was writing the Third Symphony in particular, he was really depressed, and he actually wanted to commit suicide at that point. Like, he wrote a suicide letter to his brother, and it was because he was losing his hearing, his marriage proposal failed, everything was unraveling. And he started writing it, and the very first movement, which on the album Mike Gordon plays on, along with Joe Russo, is called In Memory of a Great Man, which was kind of a eulogy to himself. And then there's a funeral march. And then by the end of it, the last track, the finale, actually is a little bit before then, and Rebirth is the name of the movement. It's when Ludwig decides, you know what, life didn't work out the way I thought it would. I'm not going to be able to be this great jam guy. I'm not going to be able to be an improviser, but I can still compose on the page. I can adjust my life, and I can prevail and overcome, you know. And we all, you know, it's a story of triumph over tragedy.
Well, I love that. So even in the course of, I don't know how long it takes you to write one of these symphonies, but in the course of writing the symphony, he sort of, he probably got into it so much that he was like, you know what? I do still have something to give. And that was only third. And then he gave us even more. He kept giving us. So now the one everyone knows, na-na-na-na, is the fifth. And then you're saying that you do the third and the sixth. Reed does.
And this sits, and I think Reed's going to start to incorporate others, but for right now, it's been all. There's some nights where they go out, and because it's a narrative, just like with Fish, how there's a narrative of if they were to do Game Henge, but at the same time, they can break it up and do it each song individually. With a symphony, they're telling, you know, Ludwig historically was kind of telling a story, telling a narrative. You know, with the Sitz one, it's a narrative of the seasons and of seasons as spirituality. You know, and so there's a narrative there, but you can break it up. And so they've been, you know, some nights they play the entire third symphony, some nights the entire Sitz, some nights bits and pieces. And now they're getting to that point that I personally am really excited for as a music fan, and that's where they're taking movements within movements, and they're able to quote, you know, they're able to go back and forth in ways that set lists would have lots of asterisks and arrows and things like that.
They're kind of taking the average between the third and the sixth, and it's like 4.5 symphony.
Yeah, the 4.5th symphony.
The one that Beethoven didn't even know he wrote, but he would smile because he likes improvising.
And it's 150 proof, yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
But in the meantime, the shows have been absolutely great. They've been really great.
Well, just because this will probably air mid-April, why don't you tell us what's coming up for Reed Mathis, or just at least steer us to the website?
The website is reedmathis.com, or on Facebook and all that, it's Electric Beethoven. What's coming up? Well, in mid-April, I'm not sure if this will come up before then or not, but we have we're opening for the Motet at the 9:30 Club in D.C. and at the Highland Ballroom in New York City, along with a few other dates the only reason I can't mention them here is because we are confirming them right now.
Okay.
And then after that, we have we're doing some of the summer festivals. We'll be at Camp Bisco. We'll be at Disc Jam. And some festivals like that.
Thank you so much, Benji. And you guys check out Reed Mathis, check out Electric Beethoven, and check out everything that is Benji Eisen. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it, man.
Take it easy, Benji. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, later.
All right, thanks for listening to Under the Scales. If you haven't guessed, the music that I'm playing right now is Reed Mathis from the album Beethoven, which came out in 2016. This track is called In Memory of a Great Man and features our friends Joe Russo on drums and Mike Gordon on bass. Come back next week for Holly Bowling.